From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Monsters Incorporated is nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Animated Feature Film. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the film's executive producer, John Lasseter. He's one of the most important people in the field of computer animation. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. He received a Special Achievement Academy Award for Toy Story. He's a founding member and executive vice president of Pixar Animation Studio. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews A is for American by Jill Lepore. It's about language and the effort to unite Americans in the 19th century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has approved a bill that would deregulate the way regional telephone companies offer high-speed internet services. The measure would relieve the Bell companies of the requirement that they allow competitors to use their networks. The bill was strongly opposed by consumer groups, cable, and long-distance companies, who say it would give the regional companies a monopoly. The measure is expected to face strong opposition in the Senate. The European Union's foreign policy chief visited Saudi Arabia today. Javier Solana is exploring a Middle East peace proposal from Saudi Arabia's crown prince. NPR's Kate Seeley reports.
Solana's trip marks the first visit to the kingdom by a Western leader to discuss the initiative. It proposes that Arab countries normalize ties with Israel in return for its withdrawal from all Arab territory occupied in the 1967 Mideast War. Solana's spokesman said he decided to visit Riyadh after getting a positive response to the initiative from Palestinian and some Israeli officials. Both Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres have welcomed the plan. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told Solana yesterday he'd be ready to meet Saudi leaders to discuss it. The Saudi newspaper Al Watan today urged Washington to adopt the initiative, calling it an historic opportunity for Mideast peace. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
The FBI is planning to use genetic testing in its effort to trace the anthrax spores that were used in last year's mail attacks. The Bureau has ordered laboratories around the country to provide samples of their research anthrax so it can be subjected to sophisticated DNA testing. A New Jersey man is under arrest on charges of being part of the ring that got a fake driver's license for at least one of the September 11th terrorists. Andrew Meyer reports from member station WBGO.
The FBI has charged Abdelrahman Omar Tafiq Al-Faru with producing a bogus ID and helping Hani Hanjour to do the same. Hanjour was one of the suspected hijackers on one of the planes which crashed into the World Trade Center. The criminal complaint against Al-Faru states the hijackers exploited a loophole that allowed people to get ID cards and driver's licenses from Virginia without having proof of ID or residency. The loophole was closed shortly after the September 11th attacks. Al-Faru told the FBI a colleague at the Clifton, New Jersey gas station where he worked helped him get his own ID for $600. The Virginia address Al-Faru used was the same as the one in Hanjour's ID. The FBI says two of the suspected hijackers on the jet that hit the Pentagon also used that same address. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Meyer in Newark.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 12 points to close at 10,128 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 15 to close at 1,752. The S&P 500 gained a fraction. This is NPR News. The State Department is offering up to $5 million in rewards for information leading to the capture or conviction of the killers of Daniel Pearl. The reward will be advertised in Pakistan, where assailants kidnapped and killed the Wall Street Journal reporter. The man described as the godfather of British comedy died today. His agent said he had kidney failure. Spike Milligan was the creative force behind the BBC radio comedy Goon Show of the 1950s that also featured Peter Sellers. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from London.
Spike Milligan's creative genius is credited with introducing post-World War II Britain to a new form of zany comedy. Milligan wrote and played the parts in the BBC's Goon Show, with Eccles the most memorable. On being asked by Peter Sellers' character, Bluebottle, why he carried a piece of paper with the time written on it, Eccles was ready with his own brand of logic.
When I asked a fella to write it down, it was 8 o'clock.
Well, then,
Supposing when somebody asks you the time, it isn't 8 o'clock.
Well, then I don't show it to them.
Milligan had success on stage and television and wrote 50 books. His offbeat irreverence inspired the creators of Monty Python a generation later. He died at the age of 83. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
President Bush is considering sending military advisors and equipment to the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. The president said the administration wants to help countries root out terrorists linked to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. So far, officials say there's been no specific plan for providing the military assistance that Georgia has requested. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Monsters, Incorporated is nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Animated Feature Film. Some critics included the film on their year-end 10 best lists. My guest, John Lasseter, is the executive producer of Monsters, Incorporated. He also directed the animated films Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. These are films which not only made great strides in computer animation techniques, they were very popular among children and adults. Lasseter received a Special Achievement Oscar for Toy Story. In 1988, his short film Tin Toy became the first computer animated film to win an Oscar. Lasseter is a founding member of the Pixar Animation Studio and is now executive vice president. Let's start with a scene from Monsters, Incorporated, a comedy about monsters who get their power by scaring children and making them scream. The two lead animated monsters are voiced by Billy Crystal and John Goodman. In this scene, they sit down to watch a new commercial that they're featured in.
Look, the new commercial's on!
The future is bright at Monsters, Incorporated.
I'm in this
We're
one.
Part
I'm
of
in
your
this one.
Life. We power your car. We warm your home. We light your city.
I'm Monsters Incorporated.
Hey, look, Betty!
Carefully matching every child to their ideal monster to produce superior scream, refined into clean, dependable energy. Every time you turn something on, Monsters Incorporated is there.
I'm Monsters Incorporated.
We know the challenge. The window of innocence is shrinking. Human kids are harder to scare.
Of course, MI is prepared for the future. With the top scarers, the best refineries, and research into new energy techniques.
Okay, here I come.
We're working for a better tomorrow. Today.
We're Monsters Incorporated.
We're MI, Monsters Incorporated. We scare because we care.
I can't believe it.
Oh, Mike.
I was on TV! Ah, did you see me? I'm a natural! Hello? I know! Hey, wasn't I great? Did the whole family see it? It's your mom. What can I say? The camera loves me.
John Lasseter, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Let's talk about the making of Monsters Incorporated. Where did the story originate, the idea of monsters needing to acquire the screams of children, otherwise they have no power?
Pete Docter, the director, he was the supervising animator on Toy Story when I was directing it. And one of the things we all loved about Toy Story was we tapped into something that was really familiar to all of us as kids. That, you know, this feeling that when you leave a room, you kind of look back and you wonder if your toys come alive when you're not around. Well, we thought, wouldn't it be great to have something else like that, that was just a known fact as a child? And he came up with the idea that you know, there are monsters in our closets or under our beds, you know, waiting to scare us when the parents leave and turn out the light. I mean, that's a known fact across the world. And then we can try to answer the question, why? Why do monsters come in and scare us? And then he said, we need something where the monsters get something kind of tangible from the human world to, you know, make it, give them the reason why they go into the kids' room. And we thought, well, you know, I have 5 sons, and I know that kids are complete unstable sources of energy. We thought, well, what if they go in there and they scare the kids? When they scream, they actually capture this scream and refine it into a clean, efficient fuel. And so, therefore, Monsters Incorporated is like an energy company in the monster world. And once we had that, we created this entire world, and it's very dense. I mean, there's a lot of ideas in there that never made it to the film, but it kind of gives the believability to the world. For instance, they're all members of the Screamsters Union, and
right.
And they have, you know, they have breaks and you know, eat donuts like everybody else, but their donuts are ones that we wouldn't want to touch. And
well, one of the things I like about your movies is that they have social satire in them. And in this instance, in Monsters Incorporated, there's this big monster corporation that has, you know, its own branding and
right.
TV commercials and
right.
all the stuff that we expect from, you know, corporations, a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like having the chance to get in social satire in a kid's film?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's part of the thing that adults get and actually are entertained by, the kid that are over the kids' heads. I mean, the kids are just enjoying the characters and the adventure and the slapstick and all that. And where the adults are kind of getting these comparisons to our world. Like in Toy Story, for instance, one of the big things was to make the personalities of the toys be adult and not to be childlike personalities. And so when Andy left the room and the toys came alive, that was like a workplace. Being a toy and being played with was like their job. And so they had staff meetings. They had plastic corrosion awareness meetings. They had, you know, and all these concerns and worries that actually are much more, you know, relate to us as adults than kids, you know. And in the same way with Monsters Incorporated, we looked at this corporate world and we studied, for instance, the graphic design that happens within big corporations and how they have, you know, everything is done exactly. We figured that with capturing Scream from kids, that their boom time actually was in the 50s during the baby boom era. There were so many kids all over the place that they just were making money hands over fist, and that's when they expanded tremendously. And so when you look at the architecture in the movie of Monsters Incorporated, it has a very 60s look to it, late 50s, early 60s. We studied the architecture of like Brasilia, you know, and all these places where it's just this nutty architecture from the 60s that are really cool. And so we modeled it after that because thinking that's when they were expanded tremendously. The graphic design had very much of a feeling of Paul Rand, you know, the great graphic designer who designed a lot of elements, you know, in corporations back then, the UPS logo, the CBS logo, on and on and on. And all those things brought together, and so it had made for a believable world. If there was a world beyond a closet door full of monsters, yeah, that's what it would be like.
Let's talk about creating the monsters. I mean, you can't do research exactly on what monsters look like, although we all know monsters. We all know Godzilla.
Right.
You know, we all have a lot of monsters in common. So what's the process like? I'm sure there was several animators and designers who were working mm-hmm. on the monsters. Maybe you could just let us in a little on the design process.
What we did is in creating the world of Monsters Incorporated, the monsters in this world, we wanted to find kind of a style of monster that could be unique to Monsters Incorporated. So we did a lot of research and looked at, you know, the history of monsters in cinema and TV and so on, and even in children's books. And we saw that there was a certain style that, say, the Muppets had, a certain style that Maurice Sendak has in Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah, I think the John Goodman monster is very Where the Wild Things Are.
And then, of course, there's the Ray Harryhausen creatures that in fact, Ray Harryhausen visited the studio, and we talked quite a bit about it. And he actually said one thing that really was...
Let me just stop you and say Ray Harryhausen is the king of stop time animation.
Yeah, stop motion.
Stop motion, thank you.
Yeah. You know, with this tremendous, you know, influence that he's had on creatures and monsters, he said one thing that was really important to us, and that was that the monsters in his film are only monsters when they're provoked. He said they're just regular creatures. In fact, he doesn't even like to use the word monsters. He uses the word creatures. And they're just living their regular life. And then it's always the outsider, the human, that comes in and sort of provokes them. And then they become monstrous. And it was a very interesting insight. And so what we did is we looked at all these existing sort of monster worlds and monster designs that have been out there, and we tried to find something that was unique. One of the things that we did is, knowing our medium of computer animation and how it can produce things that almost look real, that are really photorealistic, we started looking at the animal world and looking at textures and elements. And we pulled from, like, Mike Wazowski, the lime green one-eyed guy with that Billy Crystal does the great voice for. His skin is very much like a Brazilian tree frog. It has this kind of reptilian skin. We studied that. Sully has... You know, it's completely covered with fur, and the fur is inspired from yak fur. It has a certain kind of matting quality that it has. And the horns are like a ram's horns. And we actually got these elements in and really studied them and created textures that look like this. But we said, you know, what we want to do is then... We don't want to make it look just like a real animal, because we started actually coloring Sully more of kind of an orange and a natural look to him, and they just look like animals. And so what we did is thought about, well, they come into kids' rooms and scare kids, and kids sit there and draw these magnificent images of what monsters look like. And so we said, well, why don't we have these realistic textures, but then have them colored like what a kid's imagination, what their monsters would look like. And so that's when Sully became this turquoise blue with purple polka dots, and Mike became lime green. And in all of the monsters that actually go in and scare the kids are these incredible bright colors. You know, the monsters in Monsters Incorporated that's just are the support monsters for the scarers, they're a much kind of duller colors. You know, it's really the bright colored monsters are the ones that go in and scare the kids. But it's this combination of kind of research and then thinking through, you know, the world and the process of, like, okay, these monsters come in and scare kids, you know, and it's a kid's point of view is what they see with the monsters. That's where this kind of the unique world of our monsters came into being.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Lasseter, and he's the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life, and he's a vice president at Pixar Animation Studios. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Lasseter, and he's the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. How do you match actors' voices to the monsters? No, I mean, like Billy Crystal and John Goodman, these are famous names. You know what they sound like. I don't know whether you feel you need the need to audition them first or not. But can you talk a little bit about the process of matching up this... this imaginary monster with a real actor's voice?
At Pixar, when we're developing the story and developing the character, we're always thinking about a particular actor. Sometimes they're actually older actors that have passed away, but it's a type of character that we're looking for. Then when it comes down to the voice, casting the voice, we'll make a list of actors we think that could fit that particular type of character. And to try it out, we will find a performance in a movie or a TV show that they've done. We'll take just the audio of this and put it against drawings or images of the character, just still images. And it's amazing how you could sit back and you can look at this, and some actors, you know, they're brilliant actors, but you realize there's a lot of it has to do with the way they look and their facial expressions and their movement and so on that adds to their brilliance in acting. And when their voice is there, it's kind of just by itself, it's kind of flat. And we then take other actors and we'll put up there, and they just jump off the screen, and they're great. And we tend to go for an actor not by how big of a star they are, but by how great of an actor they are. Two, we never ask an actor to put on a voice. We want them to be natural, because it's just part of our our thing is we want the characters to be just completely natural and real, you know, even though they're a toy, a bug, or a monster, you know. And then what we'll do is always look for people that have great ad-lib ability. Trying to find spontaneity in this laborious process of making an animated film frame by frame by frame is something that we always are striving for. And part of that is in the recording of the actor. We have a script. You know, they come in before the animation's done, so they really have nothing to look at. Generally, they're there by themselves in a studio with a mic in front of them. And we're always trying to get them to make the scene, make the dialogue their own, make it just sound absolutely as natural as possible. And so when you get someone who's so brilliant like Billy Crystal to come in, he just gives you, it's like he's got a staff of writers in his head. He will give you 100 variations of everything. And we actually got him and John Goodman together. And they were amazing because the two characters needed to be like friends since kindergarten. And so by getting them in there, all of a sudden, they had never met each other before, but they came in and they just, it went up to another level. These guys knew each other since kindergarten in the performances, and it was really incredible.
So when you're doing the computer-generated animation, what other things that the artist needs to know about the characters and how each of the characters look from every angle in order for the computer programs to do what they need to do?
In computer animation, it's a little more like model animation where we model within the computer a three-dimensional model. It's just a bunch of data, but it's a three-dimensional model of the character. Kind of like G.I. Joe or Barbie, where they have articulations in the arms. So G.I. Joe has more than Barbie, but it's a different interview. You need to tell the model where it's going to move and how, right? Those, and so that model is then given to the animator along with the scene, the dialogue, and so on. And so he, by animation, he's actually taking and moving the position of this existing model from frame by frame by frame. And there are so many controls on these characters. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of controls on these characters, from the basic arm movements all the way down to, you know, to the tips of the fingers. You know, there's adjustments on even the fingernails. There's tremendous animation controls in the face. It simulates the way the muscle pulls the skin around. And so we tried, even though, you know, the characters are, you know, toys, bugs, or in this case, monsters, we still model them very much that they have like a jaw line and how the jaw sort of hinges up behind the cheeks and so on. It's not just not down at the bottom of the jawline. And all these things, it just makes it, again, more believable and more real. And the animators are just unbelievable at making these inanimate digital models come alive. And the character, we're always striving to make the character look like it's thinking. Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, the great Disney animators, and I was lucky to work at Disney, and they were my mentors, they always talked about the thinking character. Every movement of the character's body and eyes and face need to be driven by its own thought process. And it just, that's one of the things that really makes these characters come alive.
So when you talk about creating a model of the character, are you talking about a model that goes right into the computer, or are you talking about a three-dimensional model that is then maybe photographed and put into the computer?
We start with drawings and figure out sort of what we want it to look like. And we actually create drawings with a final design that are very much like a blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have sculptors at Pixar who create clay sculptures of the characters. And generally the faces, we'll take create a very big sculpture of the face, and the clay is molded and then cast into a hard clay so that a grid line is drawn on it. This is then, and we have a three-dimensional digitizer, if you can imagine like a mouse on a computer, but only one that knows it's how far up off the table it is as well. And that is used in the digitizing of the of the face to get this three-dimensional shape, the skin, you might say, of a character's face. We also use computer modeling systems that actually take, and the modelers can actually create digital surfaces within the computer that connect, you know, all the parts of the body.
Are there any visual qualities that you really love about, say, the old Warner Brothers Looney Tunes from the days of cel animation that you can't capture in the animation that you're doing, the computerized animation?
It's interesting. In the press, there's a lot of talk about how 3D computer animation is going to replace hand-drawn animation, and I don't believe in that, because there are things that you can do in hand-drawn animation that you still can't do in 3D computer animation. Case in point, I think in Snow White, if you look at the Seven Dwarfs and the incredible animation of like Dopey, where it's just so fluid and so soft and bouncy and elastic, you know, there's something so pure about that you can see in hand-drawn animation that it just doesn't look quite the same if you do that in 3D computer animation. One of my dear friends is Glenn Keane, who's the brilliant animator at Disney. And if you look at the work he did on the main character in Tarzan, he is such an incredible draftsman that you can't, you know, that comes out of his pencil, you know, and his drawing. It's this 2D drawing. It's incredible that this kind of animation, it wouldn't be the same in 3D computer animation. And I think also in the recent Disney film Mulan, the style of that film is based upon Chinese painting, and it has a very wonderful two-dimensional quality to it. And I think you take that and you do it in 3D, somehow you would lose a lot. I think one of the things that we pride ourselves in is trying to match a subject matter to the medium that we use. When we were developing Toy Story, the look of computer animation back then, everything tended to look like it was plastic. And so naturally, you know, having the main characters be made of plastic was a perfect thing. It was a great match. The humans were much, much harder to do. We stylized them. We kind of kept them in the background because it was a Toy Story. But they were very difficult to do.
John Lasseter is the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at AudiUSA.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, directing the computer-animated films Toy Story and A Bug's Life, we continue our conversation with John Lasseter. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews A is for American. It's about the search for a language that would unite Americans in the 19th century.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Lasseter. He's the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated, which is nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Animated Feature Film. He won a Special Achievement Oscar for Toy Story, which he directed. He also directed the sequel, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. All these films were produced at the Pixar Animation Studio, where Lasseter is now executive vice president. As you mentioned before, it's an internationally known fact that monsters lurk in the closets and corners of children's bedrooms. And for Monsters Incorporated, the animators had to decide what some of those monsters looked like. When you were a kid and you knew that there were monsters in your closets, did you know what they looked like? I mean, being an animator and being somebody who has this vivid visual imagination, did you know what they looked like and what color they were? Did you draw them?
Well, I did, actually did a, when I was a student at CalArts, I did a student film. It was called Nightmare, and it was about a kid who, when the lights go out, all of his bedroom furniture changes into monsters. And I think that comes from my own memories. I always would stare. The lights would go out. Your eyes are used to the light, and there's that moment when the lights go out that everything seems pitch black. Then your eyes slowly get used to the light, and that's when, to me, I saw things change. Like, I swear there was a monster laying on the floor, and I would stare at it and stare at it and stare at it, and I swear it moved. I turned on the light, and it was actually just a pile of dirty clothes, right? But no, that was a monster, you know? And so in my mind, it was always the monsters were kind of like changing, you know, the things that you were familiar with actually became monsters when the lights went out, the more you stared at them.
I know exactly that moment that you mean. It still affects me sometimes, actually, that especially if you wear glasses and you've taken your glasses off when you go to sleep, you turn the lights off, and everything is so imaginary looking anyways, because you're not seeing well enough to see reality.
Yeah, right. I still, you know, when I walk into a dark room, I reach around to the light switch and turn it on before I go in. It's, I don't know what it is. It just, you know, I want to give that chance for the monsters all to get back to their regular positions before I come in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Lasseter. He's the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated, and he directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. He's a vice president at Pixar Animation Studios. Let's talk about your first feature, Toy Story. And in this film, you imagine what life is like for the toys in a boy's bedroom when the boy leaves the room. And you go through all the big fears that a toy might have, being replaced, being sold at a yard sale. And most of these toys are old-fashioned toys, like a cowboy doll, a dinosaur, toy soldiers, a little Bo Peep doll. And let me play a scene from very early in the movie where Woody, the cowboy doll, which is voiced by Tom Hanks, is holding a meeting of the toys to prepare for the fact that Andy, the boy who owns these toys, is going to be moving to a new house.
Hello? Check. That better? Great. Everybody hear me? Up on the shelf? Can you hear me? Great. Okay. First item today. Has everyone picked a moving buddy?
What? Moving buddy? You can't be serious.
Well, I didn't know we were supposed to have one already.
Do we have to hold hands?
Oh, yeah, you guys think this is a big joke. We've only got 1 week left before the move. I don't want any toys left behind. A moving buddy. If you don't have one, get one. All right, next. Tuesday night's plastic corrosion awareness meeting was, I think, a big success, and we want to thank Mr. Spell for putting that on for us. Thank you, Mr. Spell.
You're welcome.
Okay. One minor note here. Andy's birthday party has been moved to today. Next we have...
What do you mean the party's today? His birthday's not till next week.
What's going on down there? Is Mom losing her marbles?
Well, obviously, she wanted to have the party before the move. I'm not worried. You shouldn't be worried.
Of course Woody ain't worried. He's been Andy's favorite since kindergarten.
Hey, come on, potato head. If Woody says it's all right, then, well, darn it, it's good enough for me. Woody has never steered us wrong before.
Come on, guys. Every Christmas and birthday we go through this.
But what if Andy gets another dinosaur? A mean one. I just don't think I can take that kind of rejection.
Hey, listen. No one's getting replaced. This is Andy we're talking about. It doesn't matter how much we're played with. What matters is that we're here for Andy when he needs us. That's what we're made for, right?
John Lasseter, did you come up with the premise for Toy Story?
Well, I came up with it along with my colleagues, Andrew Stanton, Pete Docter, and Joe Rampt. And we work in collaboration at Pixar, and we just we fell in love with this because this idea of toys coming alive. I did a short film called Tin Toy back in 1988, and it was about a little small tin toy that was alive and being chased by this little drooling baby. And from the toy's point of view, it was a horrible monster. And we always loved the idea that toys being alive, we thought there was a lot more you could do with it. One thing we didn't want to do is with our first feature is just do a kind of a, what a lot of animated features were being, they were kind of like musicals with, you know, a good guy, a bad guy, comic sidekicks, a love interest. And we wanted something different, and we loved the buddy picture genre. You know, the films like Midnight Run, 48 Hours, The Defiant Ones, The Odd Couple. We just love this. One of the reasons why we love this so much was this tremendous character growth. And I think when you have a character that really grows, there's a lot of emotion there. And that's the thing that we've always strived for in our films.
So the buddies in this are the cowboy doll and the newer, more modern high-tech
right.
doll, the battery-operated computer chip.
Right.
Space doll.
In the buddy picture genre, one of the goals is to begin with the two characters being absolutely different, as different as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started thinking about, okay, we have the story, which is an old toy that's a child's favorite. And then at his birthday party, he gets a new toy, and it becomes the new favorite toy. What happens to that old toy? And that's where the essence of the story came from. And so we thought, well, we started looking at new toys, and I kind of looked around just at my own home and realized it was action figures. My sons just love action figures. So we started thinking about it, and I love Star Wars. I'm a big Star Wars nut. And so we thought, what about if it's a space action figure? You know, and so we kind of pulled from every space movie we could think of, as well as NASA and those amazing moonshots when we were growing up in the 60s. You know, with those amazing Apollo astronauts coming out with those clear helmets. They were so cool. And that's why Buzz Lightyear has a pure clear helmet. It's inspired by those NASA astronauts. So we had the new toy first. And then the old toy we were originally thinking of is like a Charlie McCarthy-style ventriloquist dummy. And so Bud Lucky, who's one of the artists that works with us, who grew up in Montana and loves the West, he came to us and said, well, why don't you make, you have a spaceman, why don't you make Woody a cowboy? We thought, that's perfect, because these characters will be as absolutely opposite as possible visually. But on a deeper level, they're very much the same. They're both classic American heroes.
My guest is John Lasseter, executive producer of Monsters Incorporated and the director of Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Lasseter is my guest, and he's the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. Let me ask you about A Bug's Life. This is a kind of epic about worker ants that are basically enslaved to the larger, more powerful grasshoppers who demand a hefty percentage of all the food that the worker ants carry away. Let me play a scene from this. The head grasshopper, the real heavy in the movie, is played by Kevin Spacey. And here he is, early in the film, issuing his demands and warnings to the ants. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is the princess ant. Phyllis Diller is the queen ant.
So where is it?
Where's my food?
Isn't it up there?
What?
The food was in a leaf sitting on
Excuse
top
me?
Of... Are you sure it's not up there?
Are you saying I'm stupid?
No.
Do I look stupid? To you. Let's just think about the logic, shall we? Let's just think about it for a second. If it was up there, would I be coming down here to your level looking for it? Why am I even talking to you? You're not the queen. You don't smell like the queen.
She's learning to take over from me, Hopper.
Oh, I see. Under new management. So it's your fault.
No, it wasn't me. It was...
First rule of leadership. Everything is your fault.
It's a bug-eat bug world out there, princess. One of those circle of life kind of things.
A scene from A Bug's Life, and my guest, John Lasseter, directed the film. A Bug's Life was kind of, in some ways, like a slave epic.
You know? A slave epic. Well, we had the idea to create, we call it an epic of miniature proportions. Because we got very inspired, actually, looking at the world from an ant's point of view. We got down, and the research we did, instead of going off to exotic locales like a lot of people get to do, we just went out to the planters in the garden in front of Pixar and stuck our heads under all the plants and looked around. And the world was amazing when you get down to that level. I love working at Pixar because we have the most wonderful geeks. And they saw us with our heads under the plants and said, you know, we can help you. And they went off and they created this tiny little video camera. We call it the bug cam. And it was put on the end of a dowel with little wheels, and we could roll it around from like an inch above the ground and look at the world. And one of the things we found at this level was that everything is translucent. A blade of grass, a fallen leaf, a petal of a flower. When the sunlight's shining through it, it's like a stained glass window, and it was spectacularly beautiful. Mm. And there was this big fallen leaf I'll never forget, and we put the little bug cam under it, and it was like all of a sudden you were in this magnificent, huge building with this beautiful, like, orange and yellow stained glass window above you. And that became one of the biggest inspirations for this. And so most of the movie kind of takes place up out of the tunnels above the ground. We had to create actually new lighting tools to get this beautiful translucency in there. It's interesting that there was the movement we found with our little bug cam. We found this tiny little beetle. He kind of looked like a black ladybug outside of Pixar. And we watched him walk around. And it was absolutely the cutest movement we've ever seen. And he kind of rolled over on his back and he tried to get up and he walked around. And we kept that footage and we studied it and showed it to the animators. And there's a really big rhino beetle in the movie called Dim. And the movements of Dim are directly from this little beetle. And the story is really fun because it's much more of an epic story than Toy Story was. And we had these great bad guys. And we did a lot of studying of grasshoppers and how they, grasshoppers are, you know, when they get together and start, like, massing, they become locusts, and it becomes these hordes, that come and take over things and just, you know, wipe out, you know, fields of wheat and so on. And we just love that idea. And when we started looking at the way they were designed, it almost looked like the back of biker jackets, Hell's Angels jackets. And so we had the idea that they were like this Hell's Angels, group that comes in and terrorizes a small Midwestern town and demands, an annual payment. And so that's where that's where kind of the idea came from. And that's where when Kevin Spacey says, leaves, he always says, let's ride. And they start up their wings, kind of like Harley's starting up. In fact, in the soundtrack, there actually is, the sound of Harley's, mixed in with kind of insect buzzing noises when they start up.
Are there any Cast of Thousands type scenes that you modeled any of the scenes in A Bug's Life on?
We studied a lot of Cast of Thousands scenes, from, all the great epic motion pictures. And it was one of the biggest challenges of A Bug's Life was to animate, hundreds and hundreds of ants. And we actually had a whole group that was devoted to just animating the crowds. And this is where the technology with computer animation using computers really worked for this movie. There's no way you could do this by hand. And what we did is we created, kind of a generic ant. And then we animated just simple movements that were happening in the background just on this generic ant. The computer then changed the shape and changed the color of the ants to make them very, very different, but the animation would still work on this. And then the computer would then propagate these characters throughout the scene in a, we would kind of take a top-down view and we would paint an area where we wanted all these characters to be, and then a point in which they would all be looking at. And you can move that point around, and their heads would move as well. And it was really amazing. It was the only way that we would have been able to animate as many ants. Because one of we kind of got ourselves into a corner with the subject matter, because ants, by nature, the living organism is the entire ant colony. It's not the individual ant. And so it's such an important thing, and it became a theme of the story, that if you individually, they can be defeated. But if they stand up together and they work together, there's nothing that they can't do. And it came out of actually studying the real ant colonies and how they work. And we realized that we had to animate an ant colony. You couldn't have an ant colony with five ants.
In designing the grasshoppers, they're the mean and ugly ones. There's a kind of creepy sound when the grasshoppers move, and I'm wondering what you use to get that sound.
Gary Reitstrom, who does all of our sound design, in fact, he's nominated for an Oscar for Monsters Incorporated, he took it as a combination of a kind of creaking leather and sort of natural... I think it was like sort of tortoiseshell kind of things. And it just sort of, as they walked, he just had this slight kind of creaky, clicking sort of sound. And it all added to this kind of creepiness. Gary has really had a tremendous influence on our films because not only he always felt that the imagery in computer animation is so realistic that you can't really put cartoony sounds on it. I think part of the believability of the worlds that we create come from the sound that Gary and his staff do, which is remarkable. And he takes a lot of kind of realistic sounds, but then combines them in ways that you wouldn't think.
You have five sons,
mm-hmm.
and you create movies that are animation films, so they're designed for the whole family. But a lot of kids go see them.
Right?
Do you have any things you particularly love or dislike about kid pop culture today?
I think what happens a lot in the kid pop culture is that the kids are told the emotions that they should be feeling when these cartoons and things are shown. I think in the great Disney films, really the classic films, emotions are discovered by the audience. They're not, the audience is not told to feel something at this time. And I think when you remember back to, when Bambi's mother was killed, or I think, to me, my favorite movie of all time is Dumbo. And when Timothy the Mouse takes Dumbo to go see his mother, who's chained up, mad elephant, so on, and they can't see each other, they can only touch by touching the tips of their trunks together. It is in the great song, Baby Mine, is sung at the time. That is one of the most emotional scenes, and I think when I became a parent and looking at this, it makes my eyes tear up every time I see it because of the incredible true emotion that's in there. And I think in this current pop culture with the sort of music videos, MTV, all the 24-hour cartoon networks and so on, things are so quick and hip and fast and boom, 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 that rarely do you find things that actually have true emotions. And I think that's one of the things in our films at Pixar that we always strive for, almost more than anything else, is to find that emotion and let the audience discover it instead of just telling them how they should feel.
And you have a new one in the works?
We do. We have a bunch of them in the works. Our next one that's coming out from Pixar is Andrew Stanton is writing and directing it. It's called Finding Nemo, and it's with tropical fish as characters. And I tell you, never have we produced a film that the world is perfectly matched to our medium like the underwater world. It is spectacular looking, and it's so fun. It takes place on a coral reef. They go out into the big ocean. There's whales. There's sharks. There's sunken World War II submarines. There's turtles. There's jellyfish. They get caught and put into an aquarium with nutty, nutty characters. It's like a prison almost, and they almost get eaten by seagulls. And it's an amazing story. And that comes out in the summer of 2003.
Well, John Lasseter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, this has been great, Terry. I'm one of your biggest fans.
Oh, thanks. John Lasseter is the executive producer of Monsters Incorporated. He directed Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and A Bug's Life. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews A is for American. This is Fresh Air. Historian Jill Lepore won the prestigious Bancroft Prize, among other awards, for her book The Name of War, King Philip's War and the Origins of American Identity. American identity and its messy contradictions are still preoccupying Lepore in her latest book, A is for American. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Ever since I stuck a flag outside my house on the morning of September 12th, I've been engaging in sporadic debates with friends and neighbors over what exactly the American flag signifies. Some of my fellow Americans perhaps look at the flag in my flower pot and assume that I share their belief that, in the aftermath of that terrible day, George W. Bush went from amiable frat boy to Winston Churchill with a twang. Others tell me that displaying a flag means that I'm, at worst, jingoistic, at best, a victim of false patriotic consciousness. To those interested in a clear-eyed analysis of what he calls the soft anti-Americanism of a portion of the American left, I recommend Todd Gitlin's essay called Blaming America First in the January issue of Mother Jones magazine. Gitlin, the media and culture critic and former president of SDS, says he put out his own flag after September 11th as a badge of belonging, not a call to shed innocent blood. But belonging to what? That's always been a vexing question for us as Americans. At this charged moment in our history, Jill Lepore's new book, A is for American, offers some especially compelling stories about the 19th century search for a language that would unite the sprawling, chaotic young republic. According to the first national census taken by functionaries on horseback in 1790, out of a population of about 4 million, one in four people did not speak English as their first language. That's compared to one in six estimated by the 1990 U.S. census. All this linguistic diversity, then as now, seemed threatening to some native speakers of English. Lepore investigates how, in the 19th century, spelling books, syllabaries, the Morse code, and sign language, among other things, promised to strengthen the integrity of a country that, in the words of Noah Webster, was held together by little more than a cobweb. The subtitle of Lepore's book reads, Letters and Other Characters in the Newly United States. And I suspect she intends that word characters to have a double meaning, because her book is populated by an impressive variety of homegrown eccentrics, visionaries, and cranks. Foremost among them is Webster himself, who by most accounts was a boring pedant, but who put his pedantry to good use by first producing his famous spelling book to standardize the national use of the ABCs, and then his even more famous dictionary to make sure we American English speakers knew exactly what we were saying. But lest we think of Webster as a starry-eyed patriot, Lepore shows how his work, like that of some of the other six men she scrutinizes here, was motivated at least as much by anti-immigrant animus as it was by love of country. The most fervent nativist in this crowd is Samuel F.B. Morse, the inventor of the Morse code, who became caught up in designing a language of dots and dashes because he believed an international conspiracy led by the Pope was trying to undermine American democracy by exporting Catholic immigrants to the United States. Lepore also explores the ideas of less familiar figures, like William Thornton, who concocted a universal alphabet so all the world could be allied. Thomas Hopkins Gallaudet was also an American one-worlder, who thought that sign language was the natural language of humans lost at the Tower of Babel. He was instrumental in promoting sign language to instruct deaf Americans to help them achieve full and active citizenship, and to understand the Bible in the hopes of hastening the Second Coming. A couple of flaws make Lepore's book itself a little less than transcendent. The story of the slave, Abd al-Rahman Ibrahima, who used his Arabic literacy to eventually engineer his passage back to Africa, is remarkable, but its inclusion in a book about nation-building through language seems forced. And Lepore's own language is a little flat. Many of her sentences could have used an electromagnetic jolt from one of those telephonic devices another one of her subjects, Alexander Graham Bell, was always tinkering with. Those imperfections acknowledged, A is for American offers an enlightening look at our cyclical history as Americans of failing and trying to all get on the same page.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A is for American by Jill Lepore. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Crow Lake, a novel of sibling relationships by debut author Mary Lawson. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Washington Post executive editor Leonard Downey and associate editor Robert G. Kaiser. They've written a new book called The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hello. Yeah, I can hear the music in the background.